Hello, everyone. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. This is the coziest room of 1,000 people I've ever been in, I must say. I'm really impressed with California. I'm visiting from New York City. The Midtown Group. You don't mean it. You don't mean it. You're all invited to visit us at Midtown. Next month, I will be sober 16 years, and I've done it without the help of any other 12-step group. I've never been to an Al-Anon meeting. I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I don't go to Al-Anon meetings is because I don't want someone to tell me how I can work out my relationship. What I need them to do is to tell me if that relationship is going to get me drunk. And that's really very simple, simply why I don't do that. I always put a bid in for fascism. Now a little bit about myself. What it was like, how I got here, and what it's like today. I grew up in a little hamlet in Brooklyn, New York, right at the end of Brooklyn Heights. Actually, about 30 blocks from where Bill and Lois lived. God, if I only knew it at the time, right? I would have saved myself something. I went to a very strict little Catholic school, and I think I'm sober today because of those nuns. I questioned nothing. And it was very much like coming into the program. I also questioned nothing, but a lot of years were too soon before I knew that. I married young, went to work in an advertising agency. It was a difficult marriage, even though we both knew the rules. He went to work in a family construction business. I worked for an advertising agency. I came home every night. I cooked meals. I mean, it was very clearly defined. And it was okay. It worked. You know, of course, later on they changed all the rules on us and things got a little convoluted. But while it was working, we were having some problems. And the reason one learns quite a bit in this program about oneself. All you have to do is get really involved in these 12 steps, and you can really figure out the whole recipe of your life, really what happened. I came from a home where I had a father who was an alcoholic. He wasn't, I shouldn't say were, he was a working alcoholic. He went to work. He drank one or two nights a week with the boys, but never there was never any public drunkenness. So that later on was to be a little confusing for me. But he never had a chance, this man. I mean, he came over from Ireland. He never reached his potential. He had this disease working in him. Didn't know about the program. And if he did, I'm sure in those years, no, it wouldn't have mattered. He would not have done it, I don't think. But it caused a lot of dissension at home. He was depressed. He was dour. My mother, who I guess could be called an enabler, did the best that she could. I mean, what could she do? She was raising a family with a husband that was holding on to a job but having difficulty showing up. And we got a lot of mixed messages. I meet a man who came from a very similar home, except that there was a lot of violence in his home. Now we come together, and we're trying to eke out a marriage. And neither one of us had very good role models, so what could we do? And we tried very hard. And there were a lot of arguments. And there were a lot of more than arguments, there were things that weren't said. I lived very much in my head. Now, I had a script for life, and I was trying to follow that script, and I guess he had his own script. As far as I know, he's not an alcoholic, so my script was probably a lot more intense. I wanted to be the perfect wife, the perfect account executive. I wanted to give the best parties. I wanted to give all the advice in the neighborhood. I wanted to be the accountant, the attorney, the interior designer. I wanted to be the source of all knowledge. I didn't know how to do these things very well, but I wanted to be, maybe you'll identify, in control. I wanted this. It was important. Now, in order to do those things, I needed to drink, and I worked in an agency where everyone went out every day and drank. I mean, they, you know, there'd be cocktails for lunch. And in the beginning, it was lots of fruit cocktails, and then later on it got to be Gibson's and martinis and so forth. And I was determined to be a good martini drinker. And I said, I'll do it if it kills me, you know. And it almost did, of course. I didn't like my husband's line of work. I didn't feel that it was fitting for him to be in construction, and I, you know, was in advertising. So what we do when one has a script is you can change it and alter it and so forth, and you do whatever you have to do to get to affect this. Made sense to me. And he went to school in hotel management, and I wrote the resume and sent it, this fake resume, and sent it all over the world to the Savoy in London, you know, Plaza and Marbella in Spain. Why not? You know, if you're going to do it, do it. And he was hired by, now this is the early 60s, he was hired by the Playboy Club in New York. Now that was not in my script, you see. I didn't really want that. Anyway, that made a troubled marriage more troubled. Cute as I was, that was kind of unfair competition. So I worked all day, he worked all night, and eventually he stopped coming home. And I, being the kind of person that didn't share much about feelings, actually it wasn't even a question of sharing, I never knew, I was never in touch with any feeling. I mean, what did I know? At that time in the 60s, if you, any of you were around in the 60s, you'll remember that Jacqueline Suzanne was a favorite writer, and I spoke in Jacqueline Suzanne-ese. I mean, I said things like, you're not coming home, is there a problem? I mean, what I really was crying out for was, what are you doing? You're breaking my heart. I won't be able to live without you. See, that's the feeling, if I was at all in touch with it, but I was saying something else again. I, with my mixed messages too. Anyhow, it wasn't getting better, and I said things like, why aren't you coming home? And then one night he wasn't answering, and one night he didn't come home, and it was a weekend, you know, past. And I knew that, that was kind of major. Now, you know, as skillful as I was in my job and as the promotions were coming, I wasn't at all interested. I wasn't really goal-oriented for me at all. I wanted this wonderful marriage with this husband that had a wonderful job, and I just would sort of direct the whole thing. You know, when I went to work and I, you know, I got promotion, it was money, it was wonderful. I mean, we could always use the extra cash. He had, soon after we were married, had a malignancy that meant he had to have maximum cobalt treatment, and we weren't to have a child. And I never even considered adopting a child. And I always say this, you know, the 15 minutes that I allow myself a year of regrets, it's spent on the fact that I did not have a child. But anyway, at that time, it made sense. So now, In fact, when the marriage broke up, people said, oh, you're so fortunate, you don't have a child. And I wanted to say, I mean, what does one thing have to do with the other? Really, nothing. But the marriage did break up, and he left, and he said, what should I do? I mean, I'm with this woman. And I said, Jacqueline Suzanne's, do you love her? If you love her, you must be with her. When I was really saying, I will not survive this. If you leave, I will crumble. I will die. I will kill myself. I will do it. I'll do it in a very ladylike manner, but I will do it. I will kill myself. And he left, and I set out to kill myself, because now, while we always had parties and there was drinking and I worked, you know, in advertising, we drank. Now I drank. Now I really, you know. And I was dying very slowly, but dying I was. But I got up, you know, I showed up every day. I went to work. Now I got a little concerned about the way I was looking. I was pretty vain, and I would look in the mirror, and things were happening to my face, chubby cheeks, you know, like I wasn't eating any food, and yet my head was getting bigger, and I seemed, I don't know. Actually, when I came in this program, after 90 days, people thought I lost weight in my head. I mean, I had this massive head. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything about being an alcoholic. I mean, that wasn't who, what? I mean, what? I can stop any, I mean, powerless? I mean, if I had heard, I'd never heard the word, but had I heard it, it wouldn't have pertained to me. I wasn't ever powerless. Well, I decided to see, I went into therapy, of course, and I lied, you know, I lied to the therapist. And again, lied. I didn't know what the truth was. I didn't go there consciously make up stories. I just had no idea what I would hope that on Wednesdays something would happen that I could discuss with him. I'd say, well, just something should be happening so that I can discuss it with him. Instead, I would ask him about his, you know, the ballet that he went to. I mean, and I was giving up something like 2/3 of my pay for therapy at the time. And one time I mentioned the fact that I was drinking. I thought I was drinking a little too much. I said it like, I think I'm drinking too much, you know. And he said the kicker, if you're an alcoholic, I can't treat you. So I never brought it up again. There was no way, because I didn't have anywhere else to go, and I didn't know what to do about that. And nothing was happening on Wednesdays any differently than Tuesdays, and I kept going. I started to see a man who was to spend the next 5 years with me and take care of me through my alcoholism. And he really didn't know how much I was drinking. And I said to him one day, even him not knowing, I said, do you think I could be developing a dependency on alcohol? No. And I, of course, he didn't fall off the chair. He said, yeah, I think you might. And the man had no idea really how much I was. Well, he said, you know, I work with a number of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And just the words, Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, and they have lots of literature, and I'd like to get you some. And I said, fine. And he gave me the literature the next week, and I hid it in the bottom drawer. But I didn't throw it away, right? That was most telling, the fact that I didn't throw it away. I mean, I would turn off public service messages about drinking. But here I kept that in the bottom, you know, in the back of all the way back, things covering it up. And now I'm getting more frightened because I had the worst anxiety attacks in the world. I mean, the worst they were. Half of my body would be leaving me, would be going one direction where my head I felt was being pulled in another, and I was gasping for breath all the time. And I was always clutching my chest like, you know. I mean, I didn't look too professional or too executive-like while this was going on. And I think, you know, what I had, the only thing that I had going for me really was the fact that I had years of hard work and a reputation as a professional behind me. because I certainly would never have been able to keep that job. These people just thought, meanwhile, I never told them about the separation. I mean, talk about not being able to share. I didn't tell them because I didn't know. There wasn't any margin in my life for failure. How could I tell them? I failed in a marriage. I mean, they came to me when they had problems in their marriage. I mean, they discussed it with me. How could I admit, you know, I failed? And, of course, I was willing to take 100% of the blame. So I kept drinking and trying to really drink away misery and failure and unhappiness. And this man was a wonderful person that was with me, and I just, there was no way. I couldn't see beyond my own pain. And now I went on a search for doctors trying to find the magic elixir. And, of course, I was afraid of drugs. At that time, Marilyn Monroe, they thought, had OD'd on a combination of drugs and alcohol, and I didn't, that wasn't the way I wanted to go. I was going very elegantly, nicely, you know, doing it with vodka on the rocks. But I decided that I would see this new doctor, and I had read an article about the liver in you, and I went to see this doctor, and I insisted she give me this liver function test, and she didn't know why I was asking for this test. And I wanted a reason to stop drinking. See, I never dared, aside from asking this man if he thought I had a problem, there was no one else that I would dare tell. Because they might say yes. And the people I was working with were drinking as much as I was. So it seemed to me, although I've not met one of these people in this program in 16 years. Interesting. But this doctor was a young lady who was just a month out of medical school. I just thought her the fact that she was so naive would help me. I don't know. Who knew? Clutching at straws. So she told me the results of the test, that my liver was in pretty bad shape. And I remember she didn't say cirrhosis, so I said, oh, well, how are my kidneys? She says, well, they're not doing too good either. And she said, you have to make some decisions, and there's a program. And I said, doctor, you don't understand. I will never drink again. You're telling me this is caused by ingesting alcohol? She said, well, it's not helping it. I said, I will never drink again. And I believed it. You see, I thought if she gave me a reason why I shouldn't drink, I wouldn't drink. And my God, did I need to drink. Now I had to drink away the fear of death along with all the other things that were going on. And I wasn't going to tell anyone. Now, anyway, I'm sort of jumping ahead. You know, the next week I got the papers back in the mail where Blue Cross would not pick up the test, and I saw a diagnosis, cirrhosis. And it was pretty scary. I mean, I'd never had a bad cold, understand, you know, now to have cirrhosis. So now I tried to drink that away, and I couldn't get a buzz. And every Sunday I was stopping drinking. Sunday was my last drink. Well, Sundays would come, you know, I would go out in a blast, drink everything there was. Well, I always made sure that I had enough drink. I never ran out of alcohol. I never ran out of two things, booze or cigarettes, ever. Would run out of food, milk, you know, base essentials, never what I really needed to live. And one Monday did come, and I did not drink, and it was Monday night, and I went on Tuesday, and I went to bed at 8 o'clock, because what do you do when you're not drinking? And on Wednesday, I went to therapy, and now I was, in addition to being in private sessions, I was in group, and I said, I am never drinking again. And I thought to myself, how simple. I mean, I stopped. And then it got to be Friday, and I knew there's no way. I walked in to my apartment, I got to the center of the living room, and I started to shrink in stature. And I said, I can't do it. I'm going to drink. And I thought, if you drink, you will die. And I said, I will die then. I mean, I actually remembered thinking that. And then something happened. Something said, that little envelope in the bottom of the drawer. So to me, when people talk about the surrender, that beautiful moment of surrender for me was walking from my living room 8 feet into the bedroom, into that drawer, and I picked up that envelope. And I remember sitting on the couch, sitting up straight, being very frightened, praying for the first time in 100 years. And the reason I didn't leave God. I mean, I thought he left me. Why would he want me? And I prayed and I called into group, and this man by the name of Adam, who I mention in my prayers every day, said, AA, can I help you? And I said, I have a friend that needs a meeting. And he said, this was it, he said, that's exactly what I said 3.5 years ago. And that broke the ice, and he had someone call me, and I was very nervous. I remember sitting up straight. I wanted to give her all the right answers, and she asked me how long I'd been drinking, and I said, 3 or 4 months. How long? I believed it at the time. I had no idea of truth. I mean, what? She said, how much? Did you have a drink today? And I was insulted. I said, absolutely not. She said, well, you should have a meeting before the bars close. And I said, bars? I mean, I was outraged. I said, listen, I am not drinking in bars. And what I really meant was, I am killing myself very elegantly. I mean, right here on the right side of my couch, I'm doing it. I'm not doing a little lampshade on my head. I'm not having any fun while I'm dying. And I made arrangements to go to meet her the next day, and I was very excited. I was going to see what an alcoholic looked like. And she met me and took me to Madison 73. It was on the fifth floor. We got on the elevator. Now, it seemed to me that she interviewed me on the whole bus ride up there, and I wanted to say the right thing. She said, you know, how old are you? I probably took 5 years off, you know. What kind of work you do? I didn't want to give her too much information. I mean, what was she going to do with this information? Now, as we walked in the door of Madison 73, there's a little desk there, and I thought, oh, no, you know, I'm not signing anything. And we got to the fifth floor, and she said, I know I'm home when I smell coffee. And I thought, oh, well, this is it, Peg, you know. This is going to be life in the big city. You will come here on Saturday nights and you will drink coffee. And do you know, if that's what happened to me, I would have taken it. I would have said, really? The rest of my life, Saturday night? Where do I sign? Because as soon as I walked in that room, thank God, I was not mocus enough not to see what I could see. These people were smiling. They were hugging each other. They were very much what happened here tonight. And I observed that. I didn't want to hug anyone for 100 years. I mean, who was laughing? My face was frozen in a frown. Their eyes, they had white. I had varicose veins. The Visine was not working. And they were beautiful. They looked as though they ran into this meeting on their way to a party. And they were at a party. And everyone, she introduced me to everyone practically at the meeting. And I said, could they be all alcoholics? And she says, and she didn't know how she should answer that. She said, well, you know, they don't have to be. It's an open meeting. So I thought, oh, they probably just came in tonight to hear, you know, information. Imagine walking in off the street to an AA meeting to get some information. So I looked around. I said, well, that's, you know, I said, they probably think that I'm one of these people getting information. So it's okay. And I was a bit haughty, you know. I thought I was extremely well-dressed, and, you know, I looked at them, and, you know, but what I really, you know, what was really happening, in spite of, you know, the haughtiness, I was saying, how do I stay here? How do I get back tomorrow? Will you accept me? Will you save my life? Will you help me in spite of what's going on? Am I good enough to be in this room? Do I deserve to live? None of that, you know, was I saying that night, but that's really where it was at. And I went to a meeting the next day. Well, actually, you know, that night when I left, the person that left that room was not the person that walked in. 100 pounds was taken off my back. I had been so frightened. I actually said to someone that night, in a whisper, but I did say it. I said, I've been frightened. I mean, that said tones. It said volumes. This person said, yeah, we all are. You know, we're all frightened. And I walked out that night, and I met the gentleman I was seeing, and we were meeting another couple for dinner, and I entertained them with the three qualifications that I heard. I thought that was perfectly okay, you know. But they knew I was excited about something. They said, alcoholics, is that like Weight Watchers? You know, is that what it's like? And I said, yes, and I went, and I think I'm an alcoholic, and I should never drink again. And so I still didn't tell them, you know, the prognosis. But I wanted to come back, and I came back the next day, and the journey began. And what a journey. Now, if you would have asked me that night, well, what would you like in the next 15 years to happen? Well, you know, would I have been shortchanged? I would have said, well, I'd probably like a couple of bucks raised. Probably, maybe a bigger apartment, you know, maybe a better looking boyfriend, new car. And what do you think has happened in all these years? All of that stuff, I did get, of course. I got all the material things. And they've been incredible. But I've got something so much better than that. I mean, I have learned how to take incredible risks. You know, when I said about how I would have written, you know, a better job, a couple of bucks, the kind of risks I take today, I go for it because I know that whether I get it or not doesn't really matter. See, it's just the effort. I mean, you're looking at an effort-oriented person. The results are up to God. I mean, I have a relationship with a higher power that I got in these rooms. Early on, they told me that the fellowship would be meetings, but the program would be our 12 steps, and that it would be a good idea to get involved with them pretty quickly. So I belonged to a group. I joined Midtown, which has the step meeting every Thursday night, and we sit around little tables and we talk about the step. And you really, you can't get away from it. You know, you have got to stand up and be counted at that meeting in that room. You sit in that chair. Someone asks you, and what step? Yes, well, it's the fifth step, and what do you feel about it? And if you said you passed, they'd say, well, did you pass when the drinks were coming? No. I mean, and I remember that from the very beginning. So being who I wasn't going to fail at that meeting. And I read the step. And son of a gun, every week I learned a little something. And I learned about Peggy. And I learned about the very essentials in this program, which is love and service. I think I'm sober today really because I was made chairman of refreshments when I was sober 62 days. And I said, chairman? Me? Chairman of refreshments? I mean, I must look a lot more sober than I am. And they said, no, you can come every Tuesday and Thursday at 4:30. You'll have to get out of work a little early, and you can stay until 11 o'clock on those nights. And I went, me? Do you mean you're giving me that job? What did I do to deserve it? I couldn't believe it. It was incredible. Chairman of refreshments. I thought, no difference between chairman of the group and chairman of refreshments. And I really believe that, you know, that's why I'm sober today. I have a sponsor that was designed in heaven. She is wonderful. She would take me by the hand and introduce me to every newcomer when I was 90 days and said, now you have to look at all of these newcomers. Now you're going to go home tonight and you're going to pray for a pigeon, which is what we call them. Well, we used to. Now we call them sponsees. They no longer call them pigeons. But then it was pigeons. And she said, now you pray for a pigeon tonight. And one of these will be, you know, your... And I said, but I want to be the pigeon, you know, I don't want to be a sponsor, you know. I said, no, that's how to get sober. You'll learn all about yourself by sponsoring. And incredible things happened. I started sponsoring people, and who did you think I learned about? With their honesty, I learned all about Peggy. They would tell me all their little secrets. And lo and behold, that's what it was. It was me. Me that they were talking about. I went back to school. You know, I never really had the credentials to do the job I was doing. And I somehow had the idea that the degree would do it. You know, it would change everything. And guess what I found out? That actually, everything was always there. You know, it was always there. You know, I was born with it all. But what this program did was allow me to take this whole incredible value system that I was really born and raised in, and polish it and hone it up. It didn't give me a set of values. I had them. And I think you all have them. And I think what this program does is actually take them and brush them off and present them to us. And we know how wonderful they are. We're able to see that. It's the peeling of the onion. I mean, I got to know Peggy in this program. And I like who she is. She's got an incredible social conscience. I would not have known that, you know, before. It was covered up with so many other things. Peggy is the kind of woman that can be counted on. She's a friend. I sponsor a lot of people. And I always want to do that. I give every newcomer that asks me my number. And I have to do that because they don't all call. And I want to be sure that that there are enough people out there that are going to keep me sober. If they don't see me at a meeting, I want them calling me. And I know that everything I do is really it's really for me. The program is absolutely incredible. I didn't mention to you that I was a Girl Scout growing up. So now I what I think about that is that I must have been an incredibly wonderful Girl Scout and that I did something extra nice as a Girl Scout. We were always encouraged to, you know, help elderly people across the street. I think I did that a lot, and I think I was rewarded with this program. I think I was rewarded with the disease of alcoholism so that I could come to AA, one of the lucky ones, you know, that got here. And I love being sober. I love this program. I will come to meetings for the rest of my life. And if you don't see me, call me in California. And I thank you for my sobriety. Thank you.